KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Stanford physics professor and author Leonard Susskind joins us in the hour ahead to discuss a major controversy over black holes and why he and Stephen Hawking disagree and hold incompatible theories about how the universe works. His newest book is called The Black Hole Wars, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. Leonard Susskind, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Either famed theoretical physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking is right in positing that matter is completely lost once it's sucked up into a black hole, or he's wrong and matter can never be lost. These antithetical ideas about how the universe works present, according to theoretical physicist Leonard Susskind, who takes a view opposed to Hawking's, enormous stakes for modern science. Professor Susskind gives us his version of the black hole dispute in his recently published book. It's called The Black Hole War, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. Author of The Cosmic Landscape and Felix Bloch Professor of Theoretical Physics at Stanford University, Leonard Susskind is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he joins us for this forum hour. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be back.
Well, let's begin by talking about this battle, because a lot is at stake here. I mean, it gets down to information either being lost, as I said, in black holes, or not being lost. And let me go back to the story itself, because it's interesting. Little did I know when I tackled your book that you'd start off in San Francisco with Werner Erhard, of all people,
who may
not remember. It was the founder of, something called Erhard Seminar Trainings. Used to tell people they couldn't go to the toilet and all that.
At least according to myth.
Well, I don't know if it's according to myth. I know people went through that training who said that was indeed the case. But he invited a lot of physicists over, and you were one of them, and Hawking was another one of them. And that's sort of where it begins. So take us from there.
Yeah, well, Werner, who was really Jack Goldberg, was a
Rosenberg, I think. Jack Rosenberg.
Jack Rosenberg. What did I say?
Goldberg.
Goldberg,
Rosenberg.
Same thing. He was a physics groupie. He had all his groupies around him, but he was, ironically, a groupie himself. And he had his buddies, his physics buddies, that he liked to have dinner with every so often. That included myself, Dick Feynman, a few other physicists. And at some point, he decided he would like to run some conferences, little workshops, we call them, where a small group of physicists, usually eminent physicists, would get together and discuss the latest problems. So in the book, incidentally, I said it was 1983. It wasn't 1983. Very recently, I had dinner with Stephen Hawking, and I read to him a little from my book. And I began by the little chapter where I described how we met in 1983. And about 5 minutes later, he said, "I think it was 1981. And my wife looked at me and said, "Yes, it's 1981. So it was 1981, not 1983, that we met.
You could be he could be right about the year, but he's not right about the theory. That's
right.
Well, actually, he put forth his theory in 1976, and that's where
right.
we come to the battle that you're talking
about. That's
right,
but I didn't know about it, and neither did very many people. But anyway, he shocked the hell out of myself and a physicist by the name of Gerard Atuft, a very, very famous physicist, when he got up and gave his little lecture in his own special way. And he said, when things are thrown into a black hole, information, your computer — in those days we didn't have very many computers, but a book or whatever else — that information is simply lost. It goes down into the black hole. And he himself had proved that black holes eventually evaporate. So there we were. Things go down into the black hole. The black hole evaporates. Nothing is left of those things, and they simply disappear from the world.
Which generates entropy, right?
It generates entropy and heat
and
so forth,
yeah.
Right? But it was a profound contradiction with everything that came before. There's a rule in physics, a very, very basic rule. Information is never lost. The distinctions between things are never, ever, ever lost. This goes back all the ways to Newton, that the world is deterministic. Now, the quantum world is, of course, not deterministic, but let's take the classical world. The classical world of Newton, things happen sort of like clockwork. And if you know the position and the velocity of every single molecule, every single atom in the world, you could predict the future uniquely. At least that's what Newton and his followers believed. Now, not only that, you could also run it backward. If you knew what was happening now, you could run it backward and find out what the past was like. What Stephen was saying is that if you throw things into a black hole, they simply disappear. The black hole evaporates. What comes out has absolutely no memory of the past. Impossible to reconstruct the past from what you know in the future. That really contradicted all the basic principles of physics. And if it were true, everything would go. Energy conservation, thermodynamics, everything we knew about physics.
In fact, you mentioned all the eminent physicists would make all of them wrong, including Einstein, Feynman, Oppenheimer.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this was a shock. This was something that myself and Gerard Atuft, were absolutely stunned by.
Who is
this
a Nobel laureate, we should mention, too.
Gerard Atuft is, in my opinion, the great physicist of my generation.
A Dutch physicist. I had never heard of him.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? You know why that is? Because he didn't write a book.
He won a Nobel Prize.
He won a Nobel Prize, but he didn't write a book for the public. He and I were both very shaken by this and very upset by it. The rest of the listeners generally didn't have much reaction to it. So there we were, the most basic principle of physics went right back to Newton, simply undermined, and the problem was that Stephen seemed to prove his thesis. He seemed to prove it. He seemed to have the mathematics to prove it. And I guess you would say that it was the start of a 20-year war over the issue.
Yeah, I like the description of Stephen Hawking coming forth with this, like the Delphic Oracle. I mean, with that kind of authority, right?
Well, yeah, he does have some of that, but it's not his own. It's certainly not in any way his fault. The problem is he simply has a great deal of trouble communicating, and it takes a long time for him to compose a sentence. At that time, he had a translator. He would speak, but it was completely impossible to understand him because the muscles in his larynx or whatever it is that controls your voice were too atrophied. So some people who spent a lot of time with him could translate what he said. But it took time. It took a lot of time. And so you would submit a question to him, and a couple of minutes later would come back an answer through an intermediary. And it was very much like asking an oracle. The result was usually a short answer, and the short answer you couldn't argue with. How could you argue with it? There was no way to argue with him. So his inability to communicate was a tremendous advantage for him.
We also get a picture of Stephen Hawking that no one would have imagined as a kind of evil Knievel character.
Absolutely.
Moving in his wheelchair down in San Francisco, down one of these hills at full speed.
Absolutely.
Which is really,
Well, Stephen is in many ways an incredibly courageous human being. He's a very, very bold human being, outrageously so. He's afraid of nothing. And, yeah, he is kind of the evil Knievel of physics.
Talking to Leonard Susskind, his new book is The Black Hole War, and I want to get into this war again, but I just happen to be reading something about Einstein and Hawking recently. Strange in my eclectic taste in reading, but it said something about Einstein quoted saying, God does not play dice, because Einstein had this view of the universe as having kind of a symmetry to it or whatever.
Well, he sort of believed in determinism.
Yeah, like that, you were talking about, in fact,
exactly.
Going back to Newton, in fact. But then Hawking... I read in response to the statement said, yeah, God does play dice, and sometimes he throws them where they can't be seen.
Right.
Well, there's a sharp difference between those two.
Well, most physicists today believe in quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics has a random element to it. But the random element is very, very controlled and very, very special. It's not just your standard dice player's randomness. It's much, much more subtle than that. Einstein knew that. He certainly knew that. But Stephen was going beyond what Einstein was worried about. He said that things were more random even than standard quantum mechanics. And that was the big trouble. That is where we began to get in trouble, because if things were more random than standard quantum mechanics, everything we knew about physics went down the hole.
We've got a little explaining, I guess, maybe. You do it very well to a lay audience, but there's an old, I think, statement that nobody really understands quantum mechanics except for theoretical scientists and madmen. Or if they say they understand it, they're liars. I mean, quantum mechanics is admittedly something that somebody can conceptualize in terms of randomness and all of that with elemental physics, but it gets pretty difficult and abstract, particularly when you get into all of this stuff about holographic theories that really is at the heart of your position as opposed to Hawking's.
Well, this is not true anymore. Hawking has rescinded his views.
But, I'm talking about your point of view as it is,
as opposed to what it was.
That's right. And so how do we come to understand quantum mechanics as being or the hologram as being underlying all of this? Because that's really the key, isn't it?
It is the key. Can I say a couple of words before that about why physics is so confusing and so difficult, quantum mechanics in particular, even before I get into that?
Of course, please. I'd like to hear.
The human brain simply wasn't constructed to understand these very, very abstruse things. We were constructed by evolution to understand the world of everyday phenomena, how rocks fall, how spears fly, I don't know, whatever the standard everyday phenomena are. And our brains are constructed that way. We were not constructed to understand the Heisenberg uncertainty principle or special relativity. Those are phenomena which are way, way outside the range of things that are part of ordinary experience. And the only way that we get, I use the word grok, to grok those things.
Which Robert means Heinlein's
word. From Heinlein's word, right. Grok simply means to have some sort of intuition for them. The only way that our brains can get around them is by constructing abstract mathematical explanations of them. It's frustrating to a physicist as to a layperson that they can't visualize these things, but they can submit them to mathematical analysis. We are in a situation, once again, at the present time, where we have moved far beyond what we even previously understood. And so we're having to rewire ourselves with what I like to say, or with a new grokker, to understand things which are way beyond what we've understood in the past. Those things are the combination of quantum mechanics and gravity. And it's not surprising that when we move into a domain of things a billion, billion times smaller than a proton, that all of the old intuitions break down. So one of the old intuitions was that information, or, you know, the differences between things, just particles, are located in space in the obvious way. They fill the air in this room, fills up the room, it's located in three-dimensional space. But when pushed very, very hard, what we learned about black holes, what we learned about quantum mechanics, and what we learned about gravity gave rise to a completely new, I would say, ungrokkable description. And that description is that all the information is stored on the walls of the room, in a kind of holographic image. A hologram is a two-dimensional film which stores three-dimensional information, which you can reconstruct three-dimensional information out of. So what we've learned is that in some odd, I would say ungrokkable way, the world is a hologram. The three-dimensional world of experience is really some kind of projection of information that's stored on a kind of two-dimensional film.
Projection from pretty remote parts of space even,
From pretty remote parts of space. And this was closely coupled to the confusions about the horizons of black holes. The horizons of black holes were very, very confusing because on the one hand, it appeared that they were simply things that you could fall through with no bad effects happening to you. On the other hand, from the quantum mechanical point of view, they seemed to be places where you would get roasted, cooked, fried, and re-emitted as particles. There was a basic contradiction in combining quantum mechanics with the theory of black holes.
Where was Murray Gell-Mann in all this? I remember interviewing him because he was really the guy who discovered, to some extent, doesn't he?
Murray had nothing to do with this subject.
Didn't he have a lot to do with black holes initially?
No, nothing, zero. What? No, Murray? No. Murray was a particle physicist.
I thought he was a major, as at least my mind is perhaps deceiving me here, a figure in the terms of the understanding of black holes, because when I was reading your book, for example, I was thinking to myself, a black hole with the mass of the planet Earth would be about the size of a cranberry, and I was remembering an interview I had with Gell-Mann. Maybe that's where it all comes from, but, I mean, talk about what the mind can't get around.
Right. Well, Murray was a very, very great physicist. There's no question of it. But he didn't leave his stamp on black holes. As a matter of fact, I don't think he ever had anything to do with black holes.
Well, you certainly have.
I have.
And this story comes about in a way that really makes us understand to a greater extent not only what that battle was about, but all that was at stake, as I said earlier, just getting the mind, wrapping the mind around some of these things. You go into the mathematics to some extent, for example, and you talk about nuclear particles in the Earth, 10 to the 42nd power, as opposed to, well, the number of people on the Earth, and trying to get, I mean, what can the mind conceive in terms of beyond, say, 1,000?
I'm told that really, strictly speaking, the mind cannot grok numbers bigger than about 5. That's about where if you throw a bunch of pennies on the floor, you can instantly recognize 1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies. Somewhere around there, you begin to lose track, and when it gets to about 6 or 7 pennies, you can't tell how many are there.
But when you write about grokking early on, you're writing about an aging lion, and it's kind of, maybe that's what I was thinking of Gell-Mann, too, because he writes about jaguars and things.
That's right.
There's that aging lion just grokking.
Right.
Calculating.
Well, my point was, that's right. We're all physicists. Everybody and every animal is a physicist, and if it wasn't, it couldn't survive. The aging lion who has to chase his prey has a very, very built-in instinct, for example, for a very subtle concept. The subtle concept is relative velocity. That lion knows the relative velocity between itself and the frightened antelope that's running away. And once the relative velocity switches sign and that antelope seems to be gaining on getting away from the lion, that lion knows it and immediately stops chasing. So it has a built-in sense of relative velocity. That's extraordinary when you think about it. The idea of relative velocity is something that you normally learn in a college textbook, and yet the lion has it built in. So we all instinctively have built-in concepts of physics. They're the grokkable concepts, velocity, force. I give you a push, and you know you've been pushed. You know what force is. Acceleration, temperature. These are the things which are coming from everyday experience. But modern physics is simply not about the grokkable. It's about the things that go way beyond the grokkable, and that is why it's so hard, first of all, for us to explain it to the outside world. But the truth is, even we theoretical physicists don't really visualize in any deep sense, in any visceral sense, the things that we're doing.
You know, I think it was the last time you were on the air with me, there was a whole exchange on the internet about the discussion we had, particularly relevant to string theory, of course, mm-hmm. which you've been singularly identified with, mm-hmm. unlike Murray Gell-Mann and black holes. And
Murray was a great supporter of string theory, incidentally.
Well, but, you know, I mean, the arguments are always going back and forth that string theory is out of nowhere, that it's kind of based on faith, that it's, you know, it's totally hypothetical, it has nothing empirical behind it, et cetera, et cetera.
Grokkable, beyond grokkable. Yeah. This is one of these fake political controversies that really is non-scientific. Basically, there were a couple of characters out there who were disgruntled and so wrote books and created a blogosphere controversy. This controversy has not affected physics in any way. The subject goes ahead. String theory is a part of it. It's become a central part of it. It's become one of the primary tools of physics, from cosmology to nuclear physics. And frankly, I wish those people would just shut up.
And you go on record in this book as saying, contrary to perhaps some popular notions, that theoretical physicists are not nerds. You make that very emphatic.
Well, of course, it's up for other people to decide whether we're nerds or not. But my experience with the great theoretical physicists I've known is that they are very charismatic people, people with fascinating minds, I would say passionate about what they do, and broad intellectuals in a very, very broad sense.
More Renaissance men.
Many of them are Renaissance men. Now, the subject that they study is alien. As I said, ungrokkable. The subject that they study is alien and difficult to communicate. So I think that's the source of this myth. And I do think the myth is misplaced. I don't find theoretical physicists boring. I find them interesting people, people with lots and lots of interesting opinions about all kinds of things, very often, for example, extremely athletic. So the picture of the nerd, I think, is just a wrong one. The picture of physicists studying very alien things, alien to the ordinary human experience, that, of course, is correct.
Well, we get back to the physicist battle that you chronicle in your book, and it gets back to conservative views of quantum mechanics, as you've indicated, as opposed to, well, I guess what you characterize as conservative views of space-time.
That's right. That's right. This was a conflict between principles. The two principles were Einstein's principles of space-time, how space-time works, and basically Bohr's principles about how quantum mechanics works. Now, they seemed to run into real conflict when you tried to combine together the theory of gravity, which was Einstein's theory of space and time, and Bohr's theory of quantum mechanics. Incidentally, of course, Einstein was probably also the father of quantum mechanics, but he kind of rejected it. They ran into each other, like trains on the same track going into the opposite direction, and they didn't fit together. So it was a conflict of principles. One principle said that the horizon of a black hole is simply a point of no return. When you fall into a black hole, it's more or less like drifting down Niagara River and coming to the point where you can't outrow the river. Nothing special happens to you at that point, but you're doomed. If you're in a rowboat and you can only row so fast, and you get to the point where the river is going faster than you can row, you may not be dead, but you're doomed. That's the horizon of the black hole, a point of no return. And so the physicists, the relativist picture, Hawking's picture, which was a conservative picture about space-time, was that the horizon of a black hole is simply a point of no return and nothing bad happens to you there.
Hold that point, and we will return to it because we have to go to a break. But I want to give out the phone number. If you want to join us with Leonard Susskind, you are welcome to do so. It's toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the program with your questions or comments, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Leonard Susskind, and his new book is called The Black Hole War, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. He's also the author of Cosmic Landscape, and we're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. But Professor Susskind was in the middle of making a point here and sort of drawing the distinction between time-space on the one hand and quantum mechanics on the other with respect to this intellectual argument that was so formidable.
Well, I forgot exactly where you were, Michael.
Well, you were on the verge of a black hole is where you were, on the surface of a black hole.
Yeah, well, I was explaining that from one point of view, and it was a basic Einsteinian point of view, that the horizon of a black hole, incidentally, Einstein did not believe in black holes, but it followed from the Einsteinian point of view that the black hole horizon was nothing but a point of no return, like drifting past the point of no return on Niagara River. Nothing happens to you at that point. The bad stuff happens when you go over the falls, not when you pass the point of no return. So that was what a black hole horizon was, a point of no return from the point of view that Stephen understood, that Einstein probably would have understood. On the other hand, there was a completely radically different picture from the point of view of quantum mechanics. It was the horizon itself was a boiling, seething collection of bits of information, particles, you can call them, at a temperature which was so incredibly hot, 1,000 billion degrees. So anything from that point of view which would fall into the horizon would be evaporated, roasted, boiled, fried, turned into radiation, and just emitted from the surface of the black hole. These were two radically different points of view. One came from quantum mechanics. The other came from the general theory of relativity.
What we've come to learn, however, as you pointed out before, is like Las Vegas, what goes in black holes stays in black holes.
What goes in black holes doesn't stay in black holes.
All right, then what happens to the information that goes into black holes? I thought it holds it. It doesn't hold it?
What we found out was that these two viewpoints are compatible. You know, here's the way I describe it. Imagine Alice. Physicists are always talking about Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob are our two favorite characters. We throw Alice into a black hole with some information. Bob stays on the outside and watches the whole event. Alice, to her, the black hole horizon is like the point of no return on the Niagara River. Nothing special happens to her when she drifts past that point. She's perfectly okay. But the problem is she can't communicate it back out because it's not only she that can't outrow the river. Light signals can't outrow the river at the point of no return. And so she cannot communicate with the outside. So from Bob's point of view, Alice can never send a message from behind the horizon. On the other hand, quantum mechanics, from the point of view of the black hole, would say that what Bob sees is Alice falling into this enormously hot soup of particles, bits of information being roasted, fried, evaporated, and coming out in the form of Hawking radiation. Hawking radiation are the particles that come out of a black hole. And so, as I said, this was an enormous conflict. And the big question was, who is correct? Does Alice get killed and evaporated at the horizon, or doesn't she? Does she go through cool as a cucumber? Now, you're supposed to ask me at this point, okay, which is true?
And you've already said both.
Both are true. Grok that if you can.
Well, we'll grok that as best we can. In the meantime, we'll find out what our listeners want to find out. And Gretchen, you're first up. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Great discussion. It's very interesting. Thank you. My question is, from the average layperson, which I am, is why do black holes matter so much? They don't seem to be part of our everyday existence, at least for here, us on Earth. Why are they so important to your theory?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question. First of all, of course, black holes do exist. They are at the center of galaxies. They are the ultimate fate of certain stars. So it's just worth understanding them from that point of view. But that was not the point of view that Stephen, I, and Gerarda Tuft were obsessed with. They had to do with the foundations of physics and how physics would move forward from that point of time. The two questions which physicists need to know the answers to, or would like to know the answers to, is the structure of elementary particles, on the one hand, and what we begin to believe about elementary particles is that at the smallest distances, a billion times smaller than a proton, elementary particles may be held together by powerful gravitational forces or something like them. On the other hand, elementary particles are also controlled by quantum mechanics. We have to put these two together. We have to make sense out of the combination of them, and they always seem to be fighting each other. It's turned out, oddly and strangely, that the portals into the world of quantum gravity are large black holes and understanding them. So the principles of black holes are likely to be the things which will tell us how quantum mechanics and gravity fit together. The other area of physics, which is almost physics and cosmology, which is almost certainly going to involve the combination of quantum mechanics and gravity, is cosmology. The origin of the universe, according to most physicists and cosmologists, was a gigantic quantum event. Now, the origin of the universe was also controlled by gravity. Gravity is the most important force in cosmology. And if quantum mechanics controlled the creation of the universe, then we really have no choice but to put them together into a single package and a single picture. My own point of view, my own obsession with it, was neither of these. It was simply curiosity. Having two incompatible theories of nature was intolerable. I couldn't stand it. Neither could Gerarde Tufte. And we simply had to put the two of them together to satisfy our own curiosity. Now, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it's best I can do.
I think it does, and we'll move on to more callers. Christian, join us. Morning.
Morning. I was wondering, with regard to trying to make very, very complicated questions in physics representable, modelable, graphicable, so something that people could get a handle on in the way they can get a handle on...
Grokkable.
Less grokkable, yeah. So I had the great pleasure to know Feynman just a little tiny bit, and I'm no physicist or scientist, but... you know, I looked at his work, and he created these Feynman diagrams, which instantly helped many people be able to grok certain actions in you know, in very small particles and so forth. And whether you think there is at least that possibility that somehow these kind of representations can be either stepping stones or similar things developed for the concepts that seem to be beyond the veil of representing right now.
Boy, are you touching my heart. Dick Feynman was a good friend of mine. And yes, his ability to be able to explain the unexplainable was almost supernatural. And I've always thought of myself as trying to pattern myself after his abilities. Remind me, what did you ask? I'm having a senior moment.
How can you do these diagrams? How can you bring them to the lay public? I mean, you attempt to do this in this book to some extent, but just put them into pictures. Yeah,
I think to some extent, Feynman and I thought to some extent the same way. I noticed when I would speak to him that his thoughts always revolved around how you explain things. And I think to some extent that's true of me also. When I'm thinking about physics and trying to do physics, I'm always imagining in my head explaining it to somebody. I find that I learn from explaining. Now, I think probably Feynman, to some extent, invented his diagrams in trying to figure out simple ways of representing things so that they could be explained. Do I think it's valuable? Of course it's valuable. It's tremendously valuable, but not only to the general public, but also to the physicist who invents these things, because you learn new things by learning to explain.
Let me thank Christian for his call, and we'll move on to more of your calls. Robert joining us next. Morning, Robert.
Yes, good morning. I'm enjoying your conversation. I have a question for Dr. Susskind regarding the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which, if I'm correct, is coming up to full beam strength later in August of this year. And my question regards the finite but non-vanishing probability that a black hole can be created at this point. Could he discuss that at all in any way?
Yeah. this is a fringe idea that a real honest black hole of the kind that we're really talking about can be created at the LHC is not correct. A kind of analog black hole, a kind of thing which has the same mathematics or similar mathematics to a black hole, can be created at the LHC. However, I would say those things have already been created in a laboratory in Brookhaven, Long Island, called RIC. By colliding together enormously energetic gold nuclei, it appears that something analogous to or similar to black holes are created. I can tell you for sure that they will not swallow up the Earth, if that's what you're worried about.
Thank you for that reassurance, Leonard. Let me thank the caller. Actually, a couple of emails before I go to more of your calls. Here's Richie, who writes, if mathematics allows quantum mechanics to become more grokkable, is it a metaphor? And if so, is it an adequate one? Or is it inevitably removed from the truth?
Well, I think when mathematics is done right and it's done in an objective way, it's more than a metaphor. You tend to get things right in a very objective way if you do it right. Of course, if you do it wrong, or if your theory is wrong in an objective way, you get wrong answers. I'm not sure whether I would say that mathematics is a metaphor. In explaining physics to a broader audience, we always use metaphors and analogies. And every analogy always breaks down at some point. Even my own analogies, which are the best analogies in physics, they always break down at some point. And at that point, you have to resort to the abstract mathematics.
I didn't realize how modest you are about your analogies.
I was trying to be humorous, but I may have failed.
Here's Graham, who says, I've always been curious how physicists calculate the mass of the universe and determined that there isn't enough of the visible stuff there to balance the scale, so dark matter must be the explanation. How do you know that black holes are not the solution?
You mean, how do you know that black holes aren't dark matter?
Yeah.
I think that's a question.
I think that's a good question, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's already been ruled out. I think if dark matter was black holes, I think black holes would simply fall in and follow the non-dark matter and simply be part of the things that we call the non-dark matter. The dark matter is distributed. Incidentally, there's a big difference between dark matter and dark energy. And I think your question is appropriate, though. How do we know that black holes are not dark matter? I think real dark matter, is distributed out in the halos of galaxies in a pattern which is not consistent with them being black holes or anything else made out of ordinary material. Most likely, almost certainly, the dark matter is a form of elementary particles which, like neutrinos, are very, very hard to detect because they interact extremely weakly with matter. Black holes wouldn't have that property. So at a technical level, I think astronomers have ruled out the possibility that dark matter is just black holes. It sounds tempting. Black holes, black is dark, dark matter. Sounds like they might go together, but it seems that they don't.
Talking again with Leonard Susskind, and his new book is The Black Hole War. I'm going to go to more of your calls in just a moment, but I was in a conversation this weekend. Indulge me for a moment. It's a little bit off focus here. But the whole question came up about how do we know that the laws of the physical universe as we know them now, particularly when we keep moving in different directions and understanding more in terms of physics than we ever thought we would understand in the past, how do we know we can't exceed the speed of light? I mean, there's a civilization out there, for example, that is so advanced to ours, maybe they've learned how. I mean, this is all, you know, speculation about exobiology. But it made perfect sense to me to think, well, because I never assumed you could exceed the speed of light, but why not? If the physical laws are somewhat maybe more flexible than we can ever divine?
I don't think we absolutely know any such thing. But so much would have to be given up. So much of what we understand about space and time and causality means cause and effect. Let's just put it this way. If it turns out that it is possible in some way to exceed the speed of light, then I think we are back to scratch. We are back to the beginning. Everything that we learned since the time of 1905, meaning Einstein's special theory of relativity, must be wrong. And there's no evidence for that. The application, for example, of special relativity to atomic physics, to quantum field theory, is so incredibly accurate and describes atoms and electrons and those sorts of things with such incredible accuracy that it's hard to imagine that that the basic underlying principles are going to give way. But nevertheless, surprises always happen. So I would not want to be in the position of saying, no, it is impossible. But it certainly is impossible within the laws of physics that have worked so well over the last 100 years.
Speaking about Einstein, just for a moment, one of the things, of course, that he wanted more than anything else was to find a unified field theory. Are we anywhere nearer that in 2008?
The answer is we don't know. I'll tell you a story. In 1988, Stephen Hawking, myself, and Sidney Coleman were interviewed on Israeli television. And the El Al had lost Sidney Coleman. Sidney Coleman was a very famous physicist and very quick-witted. And El Al had lost his luggage. Well, the interviewer first asked Stephen, "Stephen, how close do you think we are to a theory of everything?" And Stephen said he believes that by the year 2000 we will have a complete theory of everything. And then the interviewer turned to Sidney and said, "Sidney, do you believe that by the year 2000 that we will have a theory of everything?" And he said, "I don't even believe that by the year 2000 El Al will find my luggage." I guess that's where I am about it.
And
I don't think we're anywhere near a theory of everything.
Think of that luggage in a black hole, maybe.
The luggage may have gone in a black hole, right?
And join us. Good morning.
I'm wondering how this debate over black holes bears on the discussion about what existed just before the Big Bang. Speaking completely as a layperson, you know, the idea of something where you have infinite gravity and everything disappears, it sure makes it seem like there must be some relationship to what existed before the Big Bang. And I, completely as a, you know, layperson, non-physicist, I'd love to know how this argument bears on that discussion.
I don't know why it is, but lay people often ask much, much better questions than physicists. The answer is we don't know. Myself, I am in your camp. I believe that this debate, the debate over information, horizons, and so forth, is a very deep one that has a great deal to do with how the universe was formed. And in fact, most of my research has been about that for the last year or two, last couple of years. There's a small group of us centered in Stanford and Berkeley and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who are trying to get a handle on exactly that question. What does all of this holographic principle idea, what does all of this the peculiar things that we've learned from black holes say about the origin of the universe? And at the moment, I think it's fair to say that we don't really know. There is no consensus about it. So I'm going to have to disappoint you and say I don't know the answer, but I'm also going to say that I think your question is one of the really central questions of cosmology and physics at the present time.
Well, thank you so much for making this topic accessible.
Thank you, Anne. And theology, we should mention as well. We'll go next to Knoxville, Tennessee. Kevin joins us from there. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. Dr. Susskind, with his example of the lion chasing the antelope, engendered a sort of a minor epiphany in me. And I was reminded of times I've been driving down the highway, a two-lane road at, 50, 60 miles an hour, and observing myself as I negotiate curves and adjust my speed and so on. And it's sort of fascinating to think about the math that's going on behind that, or the apparent math. And I realized at one point that what I'm doing is essentially just a series of increasingly accurate and more detailed approximations of the activity.
Yes.
And then it occurred to me, and here was the epiphany, it occurred to me that this is the nature of the scientific process. It's a series of increasingly more accurate and detailed approximations of our universe.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. Exactly so. You were probably not born with the innate ability to drive. You probably learned that.
Right.
You probably learned that, and you probably learned that, and it's almost a mathematical skill. We don't usually think about it as a mathematical skill, but it's almost a mathematical skill. Your grokker, your primordial standard issue grokker, probably didn't have it, and you rewired yourself. I don't think you were consciously using mathematics. That's the difference, but there is some similarity, yes.
And I thank the caller, and here is a listener, Peter, who writes, as a physicist from another field, I found Susskind's comments about string theory detractors wishing they would just shut up rather revealing. So controversy from the big greats about the nature of the quantum and black holes, that's okay, but it's not okay to be dismissive of Susskind's own big contributions to the field. Is that part of the charisma he speaks of great physicists as having, but which others simply know as the usual traits of an old boys' club?
I don't think that was a question.
I don't either. But here's one from Ron. To what extent do both Dr. Susskind and Dr. Hawking expect the Large Hadron Collider to resolve their controversy?
No, I think there are certain things that that the Large Hadron Collider could illuminate. One of them is very interesting, and I do describe it in the book in some detail. It has to do with these analog black holes that are created by very, very high-energy collisions in a laboratory. It is quite possible that in the very high-energy collisions that take place in LHC or in other laboratories, something very similar to black holes will be constructed. We'll be able to examine the physics of them, the evolution of them, what eventually happens to them, and I think most people expect that the rules of quantum mechanics will be satisfied. I think Stephen also expects that the rules of quantum mechanics will be satisfied. So we'll see in the laboratory something very, very similar, something analogous. When I use the word analogous, I have something like this in mind. The same kind of mathematics turns up very often in different contexts. For example, the solar system is a model for the atom, or the atom is a model for the solar system. We use the same mathematics to describe the two of them, and we kind of expect that anything that we learn about the solar system will have its reflection in properties of the atom. The objects that we're constructing in the Large Hadron Collider are very much like black holes, except on a scale enormously much bigger and much less energetic. If the ideas about black holes and their mathematics that I have espoused are correct, it will say one thing about what's discovered at the LHC. If Stephen's original ideas were correct, it would say something else. So I think it is possible that we will learn some things about black holes at the LHC. However, there will be these analog black holes, learning about the solar system rather than learning about atoms directly.
Talking again with Leonard Susskind, his new book is The Black Hole War, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics. And I should mention that when Professor Susskind came in this morning, he brought in a copy of my book to sign, a galley copy, which there aren't many of. Got it from Larry Mantle down in L.A., a counterpart of mine in public radio. And I mentioned in the book, actually, people often ask me how I prepare for the program, and I say I'm like a black hole. But I maybe have to revise that now.
I think you are like a black hole.
I mean, just
stuff
absorbing.
Stuff goes in, but some wonderful stuff comes out.
But it's also radiation that they go out. Right. Ether going out into the air. We're not even sure what's going on.
It comes in and it comes back out.
Let me bring in another caller. Tate, good morning.
Hey there. I have two quick questions. One, does Dr. Susskind, is that how you pronounce it?
Close.
Is it possible that maybe Stephen Hawking was just talking about our realm of experience? So anything that went into the, black hole was lost in the sense that it was no longer, it was about as relevant as the weather. Oh, that's a bad example.
I understand.
I was going to say the weather on the other side of the planet, but not pertinent.
Your question. I understand your question completely. No. Stephen and I were talking about very, very much the same thing. We were talking about, in principle, reconstruction of information. There was no question on either of our sides that we were talking about something that didn't have to do with technology or didn't have to do with practical applications or didn't have to do with usefulness to the human experience. It had to do with the foundations of the combination of quantum mechanics and gravity. There was no disagreement on that score about what we were talking about.
Let me thank the caller, and I think we've come, unfortunately, just about to the end of the hour here. The book, again, is The Black Hole War. Leonard Susskind is the author, and the subtitle is My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Mechanics, and a battle that really, we should mention, didn't have any real animus behind
it. No, it certainly didn't.
Disparity or anything.
Stephen and I are good friends.
And remain so, and remain mutually respectful of each other, and it's good to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Michael.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And I want to remind listeners that tomorrow we're going to be talking about the whole subject of the mentally ill in the criminal justice system and looking at new programs designed to help police and the courts avoid dangerous confrontations with mentally ill and steer them toward treatment instead of a life of incarceration. That'll be our second hour tomorrow. And our first hour, we're going to talk about trans fat, which is now on the books, law in California against trans fat, using trans fat in restaurants, and we'll find out more about that in tomorrow's first hour. We remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by simply emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.